A wide range of issues are currently on the docket in the state legislature in Lansing that affect residents of the central UP. Debate over the dark stores tax policy, legislation addressing the increasing prevalence of illegal drugs such as meth, and natural resources and business matters are all on the table. 109th District State Representative John Kivala of Marquette joins us to share an update on these issues and more next on Media Meet. Hello and welcome to Media Meet. I'm Walt Lindela, filling in for Bill Hart. Our guest is 109th District State Representative John Kivala from Marquette. Joining us on the panel is Fox UP News anchor Justin Razavi and Mining Journal reporter Kelsey Thompson. Thanks for being here. Representative, let's start with an update on legislation that I know you've been working on quite a bit, and that's dark stores. Where are we with that?
Well, I wish I had better news than I have, but the bill was reintroduced in the House, although we don't anticipate movement on the House side. We're currently looking for a path, so to speak, through the Senate. Mm-hmm. There's immense opposition, particularly from the Michigan Chamber, and so that is right now kind of the chess game of how do we get it through. I think what you'll see probably in the next coming weeks is an introduction of a bill dealing strictly with deed restrictions. We think it fixes about 75% of the problem, and that's something we feel we can get through. Not sure that we can get the whole lift through this term.
Was there a particular part of the legislation when you were involved in it before that might have been open or susceptible to attack by the chamber?
Yeah, so essentially the whole bill was. I mean, the chamber has been adamantly opposed to it, and it's really, at the end of the day, it's a big tax cut to big business. And so when we passed it 97-11 out of the House last term, one of the 11 no votes was the Speaker of the House, now Tom Leonard. Mm-hmm. And so that poses a problem in itself. He isn't in favor of the legislation. But in a private meeting with the Speaker, he assured me that if we could get it through the Senate, he would be willing to take it up in the House. However, I just find that a tough row to hoe, so to speak.
So you said something about deed restrictions on the new legislation. Mm-hmm. Can you go into detail on that?
Yeah, so right now, if you look at the practice that's going on, what they're doing is they're using previous sales of, you know, these old big box stores that are heavily deed restricted. They have deed restrictions placed on the properties that prohibit, you know, retail sales of clothing, food, furniture, electronics. You can't have a bakery, a deli, those types of things. And it's meant to really drive off competition so that, you know, say it's a new Walmart store across from an old store. They don't want competition there. And so they put these deed restrictions on. Well, then they go and use these sales as a comparable. And so this legislation will address that so that those types of properties won't be able to be used as a comparable.
Okay.
So locally, there's been a lot of grassroots efforts to try to advocate or address this problem, including Marquette County Citizens for Fair Share. What can people do, like the constituents in your area, to support this legislation?
You know, really the key is, at this point, reaching out to Senate leadership. You know, whether that be Majority Leader Mikoff or certainly the chair of the committee on the Senate side, Senator Jack Brandenburg, those are the two individuals right now, I think, that are more of a roadblock than anybody else. I love the effort that the local group has done for the last couple of years on this. It's incredible. But we really need to get that message to the people in those decision-making roles.
Are you at liberty to project a timeline for resolution on dark store legislation?
You know, I wish I could. You know, the legislature, it, you know, doubtful before summer break. I think optimistically this fall, and again, on a deed restriction component, I think the whole lift, if at all possible, would happen in lame duck of, you know, the following year.
Is there a better chance of getting something done if it is a lame duck legislator that maybe doesn't have to worry about being so beholden to those special interests?
Not so much there. It's not essentially that we don't have the votes. It's whether or not leadership will allow it to come up for a vote. That's mm-hmm. really the challenge. That's the part of this game that, you know, until you get in it, you probably have a tough time understanding. But mm-hmm. it's not so much the vote or who introduces it. It's whether or not those people in the key roles will allow it to come up for discussion.
How about when some people talk about this idea of online shopping doing away with brick and mortar stores? Is that something that maybe needs to be looked at with thinking about the next 20 to 30 years of the state?
Absolutely. Last term we addressed, and it didn't, again, make it all the way through, but we addressed what we called the Main Street Fairness Act, and that was putting a Michigan sales tax on, you know, products that are purchased online. And it really wasn't creating a new tax, because by law, you're supposed to report anything that you purchase online and then pay that tax when you pay your taxes. Mm-hmm. And so it was just codifying that when you click, you know, to send this, you know, pair of shoes or whatever it is to your shopping cart online, that you're paying that 6% Michigan tax, kind of helping level the playing field with the local stores. It made it through the House. Again, stalled in the Senate, and I think the consensus is it's a federal issue, needs to be mandated from a federal perspective.
Does there seem to be any on the other side of the aisle? You're a Democrat. It seems like it's coming from a lot of Republicans are stopping this in the House and the Senate. Is there how is the wind blowing? How does it feel?
Yeah, you know, anytime taxes come up, there's a whole contingent that has, you know, they've already signed this no tax, no new tax pledge. And so they really don't want to listen to it. In this case, it's really, again, not a new tax, because the law is clear. You are supposed to voluntarily report that and pay it. Mm-hmm. So it's really not, in essence, a new tax, but people hide behind it.
Just take a look at a little bit of some of the things that you've been involved with lately, and that includes legislation with components that are used for manufacture of meth, and you've been actually talking about that for quite a while, going back to your campaign originally. You've had some successes with the legislation. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so we've passed so far, since I've been there, 11 bills signed into law dealing with meth, and so I've introduced the next step, which I think will have the biggest impact, and that is further restricting the sales. It's allowing someone to still purchase that 30-day amount of pseudoephedrin, which would be a Sudafed, Actifed D, Claritin D, one of those medications. It would give you the 30-day monthly supply, but cap it at 8.5 months. Mm-hmm. And the reasoning for those that say, look, you're limiting my ability, the back of the box says, if symptoms persist more than 7 days, discontinue use and see a physician. So certainly if symptoms persist more than 8.5 months, I could make that compelling case. And so effectively, we're going to lower the supply side of the key ingredient by 45%. So optimistic. Again, we got that bill through the House last term, I think with one no vote, and died in lame duck. So we're getting common theme here. We're getting a jump start and getting it out early, and I anticipate a hearing within the next couple weeks.
Kelsey, go ahead.
Can you tell us a little bit about your interest in this and what got you really focused on meth as opposed to other drugs?
Yeah, you know, I don't know what initially got me interested, but it came up a lot when I was campaigning the first time, and I said, well, I'm going to look and I'm going to try to do something. And it's kind of one of those things I've gotten to be known for. So when people have ideas or issues, they come to me more than anyone else. And so I'm kind of that meth guy downstate. You know, I'm the one that's not a good nickname. I get it. But it's really been an interest. And to me, I look at this drug and all illegal drugs are bad, right? And opiates and all of that stuff. But where meth is different is it has the manufacturing component as well, which makes it that much more dangerous because of the volatility of, you know, fires, explosion, the caustic, you know, chemicals that are used, the poisoning of little kids. So it's not just the drug use, it's the whole manufacturing aspect. So we're going to keep fighting it. Like I said, we've been successful to a degree, but we need to keep pushing it.
I've lived in the UP for 1 year. My understanding, though, is that the meth problem is a fairly recent problem. We're just curious what you believe caused that. What's changed in the last, you know, 10 years or so to where there wasn't a meth problem and then now there is?
Really, meth is the end of the road drug. And it is, made fairly easily. You can buy almost everything, if not everything, at a Walmart store. As a matter of fact, several years ago, and I believe it was St. Louis, they caught someone making meth in a Walmart. They didn't have the money to buy all the ingredients, but you could push the cart around the store and get everything you needed. And this lady was underneath a clothes rack making meth. And so it, again, it's the end of the road drug. You can purchase everything pretty inexpensively, and with a little help and a YouTube video, make it yourself at home. Extremely dangerous, extremely poisonous, and extremely addictive.
So you think the presence of there being a meth problem is a result of the lack of availability of other drugs?
I think that's part of it. But again, it's the ease of you know, acquiring what you need to do it. And again, it's more affordable than maybe some other drugs. And availability is a part of it as well. Rural areas in Michigan, this is happening more and more and more. Southwest Michigan. It's really an epidemic in that corner of the state. Very similar to the Upper Peninsula, very rural, remote areas, but very prevalent.
I actually did want to ask you about that with your colleagues as you're talking about it. Was it perceived originally as something that was a UP issue, or was it your colleagues also from the rural locations around the rest of the state that were experiencing a lot of the same things?
Yeah, you know, I thought it was a kind of a really big UP issue when I got downstate, and I found out Southwest Michigan, kind of the Kalamazoo area, has a bigger problem than in the Upper Peninsula. And so I partnered a lot with the legislators from that area, mm-hmm. Eric Nesbitt, Bob Janetsky, Margaret O'Brien, the senator, a lot of these folks, because it's a big issue. And then the other thing for me that I've learned, I'm in the minority as a Democrat. If I have four or five bills and I have one and I share the rest with Republicans, pretty good chance if it's good work, you're going to get it to the governor's desk. And so we've been able to kind of leverage that and had success.
As far as other issues that are going on, I know that you've recently been talking about, you called on the governor's office to look into a matter here in Marquette that has a connection to many communities in the UP. Tell us a little bit about that, because I know you were working with that for a while with the agency in Marquette with their office, but give us a little background on what it was and how you got involved.
Yeah, so I was brought into this over a year ago with a lot of complaints of, you know, just an abusive work environment, bullying, harassment, those types of things. And so last June, they had a little march outside of the courthouse. I attended that. And the department downstate assured me that they were going to work on it and they were going to improve morale. And so I thought things were moving in the right direction. And this past January, I had a couple of folks from the office reach out to me. And so we arranged a trip for four high-ranking officials of the department to come up and do interviews one-on-one with three different people, and then a group setting where we had 31 employees, mostly current employees, some past. And what we heard was staggering. I mean, staggering. I mean, 10 years of public service, I haven't heard anything like what was happening here. And so we worked diligently to try to find what I deemed were the right corrections for that office. And just this past week, the governor's office stepped up and helped facilitate one of the first steps, which is removing the director from that office and identifying a new director that'll take over Monday. So we're moving in the right direction.
The primary agency was which agency, and what were the services they were to provide for the community?
So Department of Health and Human Services, and really primarily Child Protective Services and Adult Protective Services. So these are the people caring for the most vulnerable in our society. Mm-hmm. And you know what? This is a hard job. It's a very hard job. It's very draining on someone from not just a physical standpoint, because you're working sometimes 16, 18. We had a case in the last few weeks where someone worked a 26-hour shift caring for a child, right? So it's physically demanding. It's emotionally demanding. You should not have the component of a hostile work environment on top of it.
My understanding is that the director wasn't terminated, that they were reassigned to a new position, I believe. Are you content with that action, or do you think maybe it wasn't strong enough?
You know, I guess I'm not going to comment too far on that. I know I will just say it's an ongoing issue right now. And my understanding is she was removed from the office. And so whether or not she gets reassigned out of the area, what happens, I'm not sure. But I know it's not done. I'll put it that way. It's not final.
There's probably a limit to what you can comment on about this. But if the complaints were about the culture as a whole, do you think that one person being removed from it is going to make a significant impact on the work culture there?
I think one person could make a significant impact. I think it's more than one, my opinion, and I've heard this. I've talked to probably 40 to 45 people so far, both current and former employees. And so I can clearly say it's more than one person. I think, again, it's an ongoing issue. I'm not trying to be vague, but a lot of this is very sensitive, very personal stuff that I've been working with a lot of employees. But the department knows what they need to do, and I think they're continuing to work in that direction.
As far as specific claims of intimidation, harassment, and bullying, what specific examples are you able to share?
You know, there were certainly cases of just harassment, demeaning behavior in front of people. I think we heard several cases of records being manipulated to support kind of the work standard that is supposed to be in place. Some sexual harassment. Again, it's hard for me to get into specifics without kind of divulging some of the personal nature. But as bad as you could imagine in a workplace, it was going on.
So I know you said this is an ongoing issue. Have you gotten any indication from the governor's office or any state officials that more action will be taken or a time frame for that at all?
Yeah, so the governor's office called me Wednesday morning to inform me of this immediate change and with the understanding that this wasn't the end, that they were continuing to work down this path, the path of correcting it, that this was the first step, and that they were continuing their investigation process. So these are civil service employees, and they have rights through that Civil Service Act. And so we have to be cognizant of that. We have to make sure that everything is done in accordance with the law. And so I believe the governor's office is doing their due diligence, but I really commend the governor. You know, that I didn't want to have to come out and take that step. I really didn't. That's not the way I typically operate. I am more a behind-the-scenes, fix-it kind of person. But I felt I needed to take that step to really get everyone's attention. And so I commend the governor for doing what they did.
So is it fair to say that your belief of the failures of the culture of the work environment there was primarily a failure of leadership, that as soon if the leadership changes, you think that those problems are going to be solved?
Yeah, I think so in this particular case. But the other thing I will say is that since I came out a couple of weeks ago and made this announcement, my office has fielded calls from all around the state. I've talked to former representatives. I've talked to current representatives that have issues like this going on. So I think it's almost a systemic nature of kind of the culture in this department. Maybe it's because they're very stressful types of jobs, but people are reporting, you know, very similar type behavior in multiple different offices, some in the UP, many downstate. So I think we're going to push. My focus was this office, which is Marquette, Alger, Schoolcraft counties that are served by this office. That was my primary focus, but I think we're going to start asking some deeper questions.
Sounds like definitely a tip of the iceberg kind of a situation. There may be more coming with that. I know you've also been working on a few things that we're taking a look at deer herd population. When we look at chronic wasting disease and other problems with that, with the border with Wisconsin. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so we actually had my bill, House Bill 4424, up for testimony this past week. I had a couple gentlemen from the UP down to testify. And what we're doing is significantly increasing the fines for bringing in a carcass from another state or province. Why is that? Because chronic wasting disease is carried in prions in the spine and in the brain of these animals, and they're cervid. So, you know, deer, elk, moose, caribou, you know, any of those classifications of mammals. And if you were to go hunting in Wyoming and bring that deer back or that elk back, those prions are in the brain, in the spine, and if you were to, say, bring it back, process it out, and throw the carcass out in the woods, those prions absorb into the soil and grow into the plants that grow there. And if a deer comes and browses, it now has that. So it's a very contagious disease, and so this is an effort to really, more than anything, bring awareness to keep those from coming into the state.
Weren't you also looking at it from the standpoint of the land border that we have with Wisconsin, where the herd there has been showing some signs of that? Because obviously, to the south, we have the water border that separates the peninsulas, but it could be more of an issue with the Wisconsin deer population and the UP.
Well, it absolutely could be, and that's where we expected that we'd see it first in Michigan, coming across the border from Wisconsin, or maybe even coming from the southern border of Indiana, where they have it. But we didn't. Where did we get it? In Michigan? Around the Lansing area. Mm-hmm. Okay? Middle of the state. How did it get there? Probably in the back of a truck. I mean, realistically.
And it seems like it's moving pretty well.
It is. So, you know, there isn't a lot that we can do from a policy perspective to prevent it. This is something we can do. And so I expect a vote out of committee next week and hopefully action on the House floor within a couple weeks.
Have you gotten a pretty good response from your fellow legislators on that?
Yeah, it's unanimous. I mean, we have zero opposition to the bill. All the sportsmen's groups are fully in support of it. The DNR is, the governor's office is. So I expect it to move through pretty easily.
I was going to move on to a new question.
Sure, go ahead.
Northern Michigan University is working to bring broadband internet access throughout the entire UP. What do you project to be the immediate impacts, both economically and culturally, to the UP once that happens?
Sure. So I'll tell you one of my finest moments as an elected official. I was the mayor when the president of the United States came here. And he came here to tout the advances that Northern was making in Wi-Fi and their communication network throughout Marquette, Nagani, Ishpeming, Gwin region, and how, you know, a handful of people, I think it was, you know, literally six guys in 6 days or something like that, that pulled this off. And so he came to basically say, look, if this small town in Upper Michigan can do this, we can do this anywhere. Now think about that. That was, I think, 6 years ago. You think about where we're at now, where from east to west, north to south of the Upper Peninsula, every child, every student having access to the internet. That's huge. I live in Marquette. We're fortunate. We have, you know, access to multiple different, you know, internet providers. But when I go to different communities throughout my house district, there are many areas where not only is there not broadband, there isn't cell service. And so what do these kids do? And we've heard from people that, you know, one lady who said, this is awesome because now I don't have to drive my kid into McDonald's every night and sit there for 1 or 2 hours while they do their homework, because that's the closest place that has internet access. So I think this is a great endeavor by Northern, once again leading the way nationally on this effort. And I applaud the MEDC for stepping up. I think it was like $6.7 million in MEDC funding that helped make this happen. So it's great news.
It also is an opportunity, I think, from the business side of it for some entrepreneurs, small business owners to be able to access it. And we can't really do business without Wi-Fi, and I'm sure that was one of the other driving factors.
Right. And so the idea is the network and the licensing they have is for education purposes. So, you know, you, Walt, you could be a lifetime learner, right? That's yes. All you have to be. Sign up and be a lifetime learner. Mm-hmm. And if you have a small business and you're an entrepreneur, you're learning every day, right? Mm-hmm. You can sign up and qualify. You're right. It gives people the opportunity to really succeed. And, you know, I'll go back 6 years to when the president was here. He talked about, you know, people having the ability to live where they want and work online. Now we're going to bring that to every corner of the Upper Peninsula. Good stuff.
Good stuff. Kelsey?
Do you have any plans to expand that, or anything you're involved with that would bring more access for non-educational purposes, like bringing people the ability to work and live, like you said, where they would like to?
Yeah, I think it's quite clear the license that Northern got, it has to be for educational purposes. And to a degree, I don't think you want to push the envelope too far, because from a commercial aspect, to service that business with all the needs they may have, that's really, in my opinion, more of the responsibility of the private sector to build out those networks. And I think that's happening. You know, companies like Peninsula Fiber Network doing great work, pushing every day more and more miles of fiber and more broadband. So I think from a commercial aspect, I'll look to the private sector to do that. But clearly from the educational perspective, this is going in the right direction.
Okay. Well,
Do you have any details on a timeline of that? Are you aware that I did research and I didn't see what the timeline was for the internet access to be throughout the UP?
Sure. So I think the plan to be done is about a 2 or 2.5 year build out. But I will tell you that they are working today. They worked yesterday. They were going to work tomorrow. They're working every single day on doing this as fast as they can. But I think overall it's a 2 to 2.5 year total build out.
We have a couple of minutes here left before we're done. I wanted to ask you real quick about the latest with energy issues for the UP. I know both chambers are working on it, and there's even some federal ties. Where are we with the latest discussions on energy future for the Upper Peninsula?
Well, so certainly we have two new power plants coming, two gas-fired power plants that are going to come to the Upper Peninsula to help replace the load that we're going to lose from the Presque Isle power plant. More than that, we continue to have conversations with the governor's office on what I and many feel is a giant part of the solution, and that is transmission to the Lower Peninsula. There were some conversations within the last few months with Canada. They have a significant amount of trapped generation in Ontario, and so the potential exists to do that connection from Canada to the Upper Peninsula that helps solidify a potential connection to the Lower Peninsula. Mm-hmm. So we continue to see that as a very important step to bring reliability and, more importantly, affordability.
I had another question. You told me last week when I talked to you that you don't, and I'm paraphrasing, you don't necessarily believe in the quote-unquote Democrat way or the quote-unquote Republican way, but in doing things the right way. But it seems like my observation is that most current politicians vote along party lines most of the time. Do you feel like you've been able to operate in the way that you said, where you don't have to vote along party lines? And do you think that that's you've been hindered by not wanting to vote along party lines in your career?
Yeah, I don't think I've been hindered. I vote the issue and I vote my district. And so I've been very clear on that. Now, when it comes to like a core Democratic principle, I'm lockstep. I'm there all the time. But there are very few of those issues, really, in the legislature. I want to say 90%+ of the issues are bipartisan. I think it's like 95 or 96% of our bills are bipartisan. So I always vote the UP and my district first. Think of every issue that we've talked about today, chronic wasting disease, the economy, electricity, all those things. Are those Republican issues or are those Democrat issues? They're not, they're UP issues. And so that's what I continue to work towards. I'm a Democrat, I'm very proud of that. And when it's a core Democratic principle, I'm there, of course I am. But everything else is district first.
And that can create some challenges, I'm sure, for you as you're working on that. Got about a minute left. Just your thoughts here as we're going into this continuing session that, about 30 seconds, let us know what you expect to see in this next term.
So certainly the budget is the biggest issue right now. And where that goes, we've got a lot of the Republican leadership wanting to turn in budgets that are hundreds of millions of dollars under the governor's recommendation so they can prove that we really had room for a tax cut. I think it's harmful in a lot of ways, so we're going to see how that plays out.
That's about all the time we have for today. I want to thank State Representative John Kivala for joining us for an update today, a legislative update. Also on the panel, from Fox UP News, anchor Justin Razavi and Mining Journal reporter Kelsey Thompson. Thanks for joining us on Media Meet.
The preceding program was produced in studios located in the Edgar L. Hardin Learning Resources Center by WNMU-TV, Northern Michigan University Public Television.